From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. If North Carolina state government should play a larger role in school construction, it seems sensible to pursue an option that makes more money available, more quickly, and at a lower overall cost. You'll learn about an option designed to meet those goals. It's called the State Capital and Infrastructure Fund. The University of North Carolina system is touting recent enrollment growth. You'll learn details and hear about how recent tuition changes played a role. The General Assembly supported changes that limit tuition burdens. The world recently marked the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing. At Western Carolina University, the celebration included comments from the youngest man ever to walk on the moon. He's Charlotte native Charlie Duke. You'll hear highlights from his public presentation. And central planners like mass transit, but most people like cars instead. You'll learn that more North Carolinians are enjoying the freedom to drive in their own cars. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Here in North Carolina, simple assault and battery is a Class 2 misdemeanor, unless you decide you're going to attack a referee during a sporting event, in which case it becomes a Class 1 offense. Now, in a recent piece posted at johnlock.org, the Locke Foundation's legal fellow, Mike Sheetzelt, writes that this is just one of many examples of this kind of disparity in the state's criminal law, and that taken together, they point to a criminal code that really needs reformed. Mike joins us now to talk about this. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, how is it possible that if I decide I don't like the ump, the ref, that they're doing just a really bad job, that I can go out there and whack them over the head, and that's considered to be much more of a problem, of a crime, than if I decide that my neighbor's lawnmower is too loud and I go whack him?
Right. You know, that's a good question. And I think that's what the problem is that's being illustrated by this, is a grading disparity. If you have if you attack one person for one reason and another person for another reason, it in general, there's really no reason to grade those differently. So why sports officials got extra protection is a question that's up for debate. I think it probably had a lot to do with an overzealous Little League parent or something, and or a group of them. There was a lot of threats being made, from what I've heard, on you know, Little League umpires and coaches. And so in order to add that extra deterrent effect, the General Assembly made the choice to make this a harsher punishment.
This happened a few years ago, right?
I believe this rule came about in 1993.
Oh,
so
this is
about a quarter century old at this point.
Interesting. So we don't know exactly how it came about, but I think what you're saying sounds probably like something that occurred. And so there may have been media stories about it, and then there's the cry from the public for somebody to, quote, do something.
Right.
And that is likely what occurred. But that is law right now. You know, in your piece, it's kind of fascinating, Mike, because you also write about disparities in other areas. And you focused in a bit on larceny. Mm-hmm. Tell us, first of all, what is larceny and how does North Carolina define it?
Well, as simple as possible, larceny is theft. You steal somebody's stuff, you've committed larceny. North Carolina defines it with kind of an ancient definition. We use a definition that you could open up a copy of Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England, which were written in the latter half of the 1760s, and is still roughly the same definition, that if you steal someone's personal property, then, you know, under certain conditions, that's larceny. And the issue with that is that personal property leaves open the theft of real property, meaning things like real estate or things that are attached to real estate. There was this distinction at common law between personal and real property. There's still a distinction between personal and real property in the law. And so if you stole real property under the common law, it wasn't larceny. And we've added tons of patches over the years to this definition of larceny as personal property rather than just incorporating wholesale all property. And that's created quite the voluminous section on larceny.
Now, some of our listeners might be thinking, that's the problem with lawyers, Mike. You know, you guys make everything so complicated. You steal somebody's stuff. That should just be obvious. You know, that's a crime. That's larceny. And then you take your punishment.
I'd be inclined to agree.
Yeah, in fact, that gets us to the point where to talking about your project here at the John Locke Foundation. You are taking a look at the criminal law in North Carolina and finding all these strange things, which really leads us to the question of reform. So tell us why this is important to someone listening to Carolina Journal Radio. Why is it important that there shouldn't be a distinction in assault and there shouldn't be a distinction in larceny?
Well, when you think about the criminal law is such a powerful tool for the state, right? The criminal law is the ability of the state to go up to you, private citizen, and take your life, your liberty, or your property away. And so the window of opportunity for the state to do that ought to be limited. At least, you know, in our conception of liberty and our conception of property rights, it ought to be limited in terms of the opportunity for the state to go in and do these things. But the problem is that over the year, we've kind of used the criminal law as a one size fits all. If we want to stop a certain kind of behavior, we just attach criminal penalties to it. And it could be as something as serious as a sexual offense, which I think most of us would agree should absolutely be criminalized. Certainly. And using silly string within the town limits of Mount Airy, which is subject to a class three misdemeanor.
Really?
Punishment. Yes, it is. By local ordinance. They have the use of silly string and snap and pops in the town limits of Mount Airy. And these kinds of, I don't want to pick on Mount Airy. These are all over the state. We can find all kinds of examples of, we just want people to stop doing this, so we criminalize it.
So Mike, how is it then that if something is happening in Mount Airy, or maybe something is happening in Wilmington and it gets put into some local ordinance deemed a crime, well, then you got the General Assembly and they may be making criminal law as well. How does anybody know? How is a North Carolinian supposed to know exactly what is a crime in this state? How is an attorney to know? How is a policymaker to know?
You know, your guess is as good as mine. There's a lot of body of law out there where people have to pull from so many different sources. And in Federalist 62, and I'm going to roughly try to quote Hamilton here, it makes no difference to the people whether the laws be made of men of their own choosing if the laws are so voluminous they cannot be read, which is a lot like the situation we have here, or so incoherent that they cannot be understood, which is another problem we have, and that's separate and apart from the issue of volume. But when you have to look through thousands and thousands of pages, it would be an all-consuming task just to know what the criminal law is. And that's a problem when, again, we start talking about the power of the state to come in and take your property, take your liberty, or in very severe cases now, fortunately, your life.
Now, you have been writing a lot about these issues with the criminal law, urging policymakers to take a look at this, to authorize a review of all of this, figure out what's going on, and to take some steps forward to make it clearer and more fair, more transparent. Where are we in that process?
Well, on Monday, we had our North Carolina Criminal Law Reform Summit and spoke with a number of policymakers and a number of interested stakeholders across the state. We are still gathering reports from the local governments, and we here are in the process of trying to chart out a course of action for the General Assembly to take. This is not going to be a quick overnight project. This is something that's going to take months, perhaps years, of compiling information, synthesizing it, and providing options to decision makers so that they can move forward in an informed manner and create a product that we can be proud of here and a product that we think will set the tone for the rest of the country.
Is there an appetite for this at the General Assembly? Because it's one of those things that may not be sexy, but is very necessary and important.
I think there's a growing attention to the issue, and more legislators have expressed a desire to be in on this project because a lot of them have seen the different corners of the harm that this might cause, either as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney, as someone who just volunteers to do expunctions to help clear someone's record. So there is a growing appetite for it, and hopefully we start to see more interest as the project moves along and the picture becomes clearer.
And that picture is becoming clearer thanks to a lot of the writing and analysis that Mike Sheetzeld has been doing here at the John Locke Foundation, and you can find all of that at johnlocke.org. Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If you think state government should do more to help fund new school buildings across North Carolina, you would choose an option that provides more money, available more quickly, and at a lower overall cost, right? Well, our next guest is here to tell us about a plan that does just that. State Representative Dean Arp is a Republican representing Union County. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
And what we're talking about with this plan that has more money available, more quickly, lower overall cost, is something called the State Capital and Infrastructure Fund. Tell us about that.
That is fantastic. We actually passed that 2 years ago, and this is the first year that it will be implemented. And we're really excited about the opportunities. North Carolina is uniquely situated, like any other state, to be able to do this. And I think it's really exciting.
What is the fund?
The fund basically is a pay-as-you-go method. Instead of appropriating 4% of your revenue to mortgage payments, we're going to set that aside and pay cash for it because we're in a great position financially and we're able to do that. We can provide more money without the interest cost of the financing and do it quicker.
Now, just so I am clear about this, what you're talking about is basically 4% of the money that's already coming in, 4% of the state's budget. You would set that aside and say, this is something we're going to devote to school construction and other construction instead of other things that we might be spending this money on.
Absolutely. We currently spend about 3.5% of the revenue, and that's the tax money that's coming in, for debt service. In other words, past borrowing that we've already done. The Debt Affordability and Advisory Committee says we can borrow up to 4%, 4.5%, and still maintain our AAA bond rating. But the great thing about it is if we're willing to go there, what we do is just do not simply borrow. We take that difference and pay cash for it. And over time, as debt goes down, we get more and more money. For instance, for every $50 million that comes off of debt service, that $50 million is available the next year and then the following year. So just by simply paying down debt service by $50 million in 5 years, you will have generated $250 million to be used for capital. Not doing anything else, taking away any other priorities, just simply paying down your debt and living within your means.
We're talking about the State Capital and Infrastructure Fund. And one of the reasons this comes up is because there has been discussion about getting the state involved more in local school construction. And one option that was put forward was a statewide bond referendum, which
that's
a lot of people are familiar with. You know,
that's
have
right.
A bond, you vote on the bond. If the bond passes, you get the money by borrowing it. SCIF has been put forward as a pay-as-you-go alternative. Why do you think this is the better alternative?
Well, glad you asked that, because first of all, we're uniquely positioned to be able to do this. The two things involve time and money over time. So we don't need, when we go out for a $2 billion bond, we don't have $2 billion that first day. We use it over time as time is needed. Just like when you're building a house, you take out a construction loan, you take draws on it over time. Well, that allows us to do the same thing here. When we take out money, instead of borrowing, we actually have cash available. For instance, I've heard people say, well, everybody borrows money for their house. But the real thing is, why would you borrow money if you had the cash to do otherwise? And that's what we're talking about.
We've talked about the fact that this would have more money available overall, available more quickly, and at a lower overall cost. Let's touch on each one of those. We're speaking with State Representative Dean Arp, Republican representing Union County, about the State Capital and Infrastructure Fund, or SCIF. So based on the original plans, there was an idea for a school bond, and then the idea was presented to use the SCIF instead with more money available for schools. Is that right?
That's right. The governor's proposed about $4.2 billion of borrowing. That's a combination of $3.9 billion in GO bonds or general obligation bonds, another $300 million in non-voter-approved debt. Totals about $4.2 billion. But the cost of that is an additional $2.4 billion.
From the interest?
From the interest cost. And that's spread out over 10 years of receiving that money in. You pay it back over 20 years. Where we are is we can do the same projects, actually more. We will actually generate $7.3 billion toward construction costs by following this plan and just simply using what's already appropriated for debt service. And as that debt service goes down, we will generate hundreds and billions of dollars for this.
So there's more money available, and there would be the lower overall cost because you don't have the interest payments. You also mentioned that this is available more quickly.
Yeah.
Tell us how that works.
Fantastic. Well, put it in perspective. We recently passed a Connect NC bond that's $2 billion. Using this method and today's position for North Carolina, our two-year budget for capital budget is $1.4 billion, and that's debt-free. Over that same time period, if we keep this up, our debt will be reduced by 62% in that same time period. So as we simply pay down the debt, we generate more and more money that can help our schools, that can be invested in our water and infrastructure, our crumbling universities and school classrooms and state agencies. We've got a $200 million a medical center that we're investing in. So,
when people talk to you about the SCIF who aren't really familiar with it, and you tell them how it works and give them the details, does anyone get the light bulb moment where they say, oh, now I get it. This does make sense.
Yeah. And people say this is too easy. People say this is too simple. There's got to be a catch. And really, there's not. It's just simple economics. And this is not a savings plan where we have to put back money and defer cost going away. We've got cash available. Like I said, in this year's budget, we've got $1.4 billion allotted for construction, and we can use it right away. And that's why we can do it so much quicker than what a bond is. People say, well, interest rates are low, 2.3%. And that's true. But you know what's lower than 2.3%? 0% interest. And that's where exciting, because by just simply using good fiscal principles, living within our means, and just simply not borrowing the money, but putting the money into capital needs over time, we can generate massive amounts of capital much, much needed for our infrastructure across North Carolina.
Once again, it is called the State Capital and Infrastructure Fund, or SCIF, and it has been put forward as a way to help fund school construction in North Carolina without having to take out the bond referendum that would lead to billions of dollars in extra interest. One of the people who is favoring the SCIF, you just heard him, State Representative Dean Arp, Republican representing Union County. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch. Appreciate it.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The University of North Carolina system is touting recent enrollment numbers. Interim President William Roper offered details to the university's Board of Governors.
We now have record enrollment, nearly 240,000 students across the UNC system. We also have had healthy growth at all three of the NC Promise institutions. At each of these, growth in enrollment is due to dramatic improvements in student retention. It's clear that our hard work to improve affordability and promote student success is paying off, and we appreciate the General Assembly's continued support of this important program. The strong showing at these institutions reflects what is happening across the entire system. Overall, our undergraduate growth is up about 1%, and combined undergraduate and graduate enrollment is up 1.3%. We've seen a slight drop in incoming freshmen, which coincides with a slowdown in the growth of high school graduates nationwide. But we've also seen a dip in the number of transfer students, which we think might reflect a strong job market that has siphoned students away from the community colleges. But more students at our institutions are staying in school and improving their odds of graduating in a timely fashion. At a time when attendance at other universities is falling, our enrollment continues to break records.
Roper singled out one particular campus that had recent bad press.
Months ago, many were concerned about ECU's enrollment and financial stability. I'm happy to report that these concerns have not been realized. Overall, enrollment at ECU has more or less remained flat, but the number of new freshmen is up considerably by 4.6%. The number of new transfer students is also up slightly. Things have also stabilized financially. Interim Chancellor Gerlach is now actively involved in approval of all expenditures, including for auxiliary bonds. While forecasts initially predicted significant losses for the physician group, these losses were reduced and the budget has been balanced. In addition, the anticipated $10 million transfer from ECU physicians to athletics proved unnecessary. The university has paid down $20 million of debt, and as of the end of the fiscal year, June 30, ECU's unrestricted cash fund balance was $231 million. Active work has been done to reduce operating expenses for fiscal years 20 and 21, and in July, Standard & Poor's confirmed the university's AA- stable credit rating.
That's UNC System Interim President William Roper. He's discussing recent enrollment trends at East Carolina and throughout the state. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. 50 years after the first moon landing, much of America revisited that major human accomplishment. At Western Carolina University, the Center for the Study of Free Enterprise hosted a discussion with the youngest man ever to walk on the moon, Charlotte native Charlie Duke.
I grew up in Lancaster, South Carolina, and it was not a dream of mine to go to the moon. And when I was a kid, Lancaster had about 8,000 people back then, and it was a big cotton mill town. And if I'd have told my mama I was going to walk on the moon, mama would have sent me to the psychiatric hospital. So wasn't a thought. But I wanted to serve my country, and so I chose the Naval Academy. Got to the Naval Academy and fell in love with airplanes. And it was an exciting time in the early 50s, 53 on to 57 when I graduated. And so back then there wasn't an Air Force Academy, and you could go in the Air Force. So I had a big debate going on in my mind, Air Force or Navy Aviation. Well, in my senior year, I had this physical, and the Navy doctor said, Midshipman Duke, you have an astigmatism in your right eye, and you don't qualify for naval aviation, but the Air Force will take you. So, so I went in the Air Force, and it's the best decision I ever made in my life. The students here, keep your antenna up. And be conscious of some little nudges in your career to take you this way, to that way, to this way, that way. And that's what happened to me.
An important event of the late 1950s helped transform Charlie Duke's life.
When I got to flight school in 1957, Sputnik went up. That was in October that year. And the beginning of the space age. A few years later, NASA selected some astronauts, and the first seven, and they began their training. By this time, I was in Germany serving as a fighter pilot and had a wonderful job. But the Air Force said, we want you to go back to graduate school. And if I'd have said no to that and stayed in Germany for another year, I never would have been to the moon.
Duke looks back at his role in the Apollo space program.
It was very exciting being there in the early days of the Apollo program. In Apollo, we had 9 missions that went to the moon. And I got to work on 5 of those missions. I was on backup crew for Apollo 13. I was in backup crew for Apollo 17. Flew to the moon on Apollo 16. And was in mission control for Apollo 10 and 11. And if you listen to the landing 50 years ago, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon. Well, I was the guy in mission control talking to them when they landed on the moon. And it was a very exciting time. The tension in mission control was out of sight, as you can imagine, because we had a lot of problems on descent. We had communication problems. We had computer problems. We had trajectory problem, and that led to a fuel problem. So we get down to minimum fuel, and I call Eagle 60 seconds, and he had 60 seconds to land. And then I called Eagle 30 seconds, and he still weren't on the ground. But they were close, and 13 seconds later, I heard Buzz say, contact, engine stop. And we knew they were on the ground. And the tension just sort of evaporated in mission control. We'd actually landed on the moon. And Neil Armstrong came back a few seconds later and says, very calmly, Houston Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. And I was so excited, I couldn't even pronounce Tranquility. It came out twang. But I corrected myself, and I said, you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot. And literally, we were holding our breath in mission control.
Astronaut Charlie Duke praises the work of the people who remained on the ground.
Mission control saved the day on so many Apollo flights. We got Apollo 13 crew back alive because of mission control. We got Apollo 11 landed on the moon because of the work of mission control. I got to land on the moon because of the work of mission control. And in every flight, something happened that mission control had to figure it out and give us a go or a no-go. They always figured it out. They always knew what to do and give us that avenue that we could go continue the mission. And Apollo 13, of course, we didn't land because we had this major problem. But mission control solved the problem. We had a spacecraft that they were in. It was made for 2 guys for 3 days. Now we have 3 guys for 4 days. How do you make it last? So it was a big problem. And but they did it, and they recovered the crew safely.
What about Charlie Duke's own trip to the moon?
Our Apollo flight was 11 days. We spent 72 hours on the moon. We had 3 excursions on the moon.
Duke narrated video of his moon adventures.
This is my most embarrassing moment, by the way. And as I disappear, the camera follows me around. And you'll see I've got a dumbbell in my arm. Well, there's $10 million worth of moon experiments right here. And as I'm walking out, they drop off. And I ruined the whole deal. In 1/6 gravity, they just lit and just rolled over once. And I picked them up, and they were not damaged at all.
What about the moon's surface?
The moon is covered with dust
very, very fine like powder, which is actually pulverized rock. The moon is rough, and no roads up there, but no traffic either. So, and we fell down a lot. You can imagine. Up there, you can't see your feet, and you trip, and here you go, get up. I got to get up. Well, that's not going to work. One more, and up you come. So,
much of Duke's work involved collecting moon rocks. Some of them are now located at Western Carolina University.
We ended up collecting 213 pounds of moonstones. Here I am trying to do it by myself, and it didn't work very well. So I had to, but I'm determined, and I can't tell you why I wanted that rock, but I got the rock this time. I pitched it up, caught the rock, but I dropped the bag I was putting it in.
When Charlie Duke left the moon, a piece of him remained.
I left a picture of my family. Up on the moon, our boys were 5 and 7 at the time. Charles is now 54, and he's in Greenville, South Carolina, and with a big family. We left the car on the moon. Here we go back into orbit. And if you want an $8 million car with a dead battery, I can tell you where to go.
That's Charlie Duke, Charlotte native, Apollo astronaut, youngest man to walk on the moon, and a recent featured speaker at Western Carolina University. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Good transportation policy begins by respecting people's choices. That's according to the John Locke Foundation's Director of Regulatory Studies, John Sanders. He wrote about this in a recent piece posted at johnlocke.org. Now, the wrong approach to transportation policy? Well, that would be trying to force people into options that really don't meet their needs. And here in North Carolina, it looks like we overwhelmingly choose personal vehicles for commuting. John joins us now to talk about some of these really fascinating statistics. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
Okay, so we North Carolinians apparently really, really like our cars and our trucks. Tell us about some of the data you've found.
Yes, I've been looking at Bureau of Transportation Statistics, which is a very hard word to spit out sometimes when you're speaking fast, data. And over the last few years, already North Carolinians were preferring their cars for commuting. But in the last few years, that preference has increased slightly.
It's really interesting because there's been so much pressure, John, and I think advocates for public transit have been telling us, no, you got to get out of your car, or you got to have more than one people in your car. Yet the data is going the other way. Interesting.
Well, I think people just intrinsically like their cars. And in fact, one of the things that's not in those data are that people are taking things like Uber and Lyft, which means that they would prefer other people's cars than even right. taking taxis or public transit.
Is it that people just want to be alone, even if they have a driver driving them in the case of Uber or Lyft, but they just want their personal time?
I think part of it is personal space. Absolutely. It would be for me. But also with your own vehicle, you suddenly have a range of options. You have more free time to go out for lunch and more choices available to you. You can make stops on the way from home. You can go to see your kids practice, or, you know, just the range of options is so much greater than if you drive and drop, you know, drop your car off and then take public transit, or if you take some of these other options, even carpooling.
I was also surprised to look at the data that you posted in your piece, John, about carpooling, because every now and then as I'm driving on the roads, and I happen to commute with my husband, so most of the time we have two people in our vehicle, but I see two people in cars fairly frequently. So I expected the data to show that carpooling would be either holding steady or becoming more popular. But that's not what you found.
No, the carpooling portion of driving, taking cars to work, fell slightly. And I think what the data are showing, especially in 2013, we had just been coming out of a prolonged recession. And so in the ensuing years, especially in North Carolina, the economy has been getting better. And I think people are opting more and more for having their own vehicles. And so they're able to take those.
And that may explain a little bit about the information you found on public transportation. Tell us about that. Who is actually taking public transit?
Very, very few people, about 1% in North Carolina, and that's down.
And yet, John, we see so much emphasis from particularly local elected officials who are always working on long-range plans for additional public transportation. So what does this data say about that?
I think one of the things the data is telling us are that we need to be paying attention to what people choose. We're going to have to deal with the fact that we're very spread out in North Carolina. This is not a bad thing, even though transit planners want to make it sound like that. It makes things difficult in the cities, but it's a good thing to have room to grow and space to move. And if we can expand into the suburbs and drive in, more power to us. I think that's a good thing.
You mentioned earlier that we're seeing more and more people wanting to drive in their cars, and we're seeing some people actually taking Uber and Lyft, so another innovation. But there's also another sector of the commuting workforce that actually isn't commuting because they're working from home.
Right. Working from home was the other major growth section that we saw in commuting choices between 2013 and 2017. That grew by several percentage points, and so it's now at 6.1%. If you're looking at people that take cars, either commuting, driving alone, or which was 80%, and people who are taking carpools, that ended up being 9 out of 10. But then 60% of those who are left were working from home, which is another thing that we can do, especially with the increase in broadband capabilities and smart work.
You would think that there would be a lot of local officials who are really trendsetters, innovators. They talk a lot about ideas of making things easier and faster for people to do, that they would pick up on some of these statistics about Uber and Lyft, about working from home, and say, you know what, maybe we need to think about our transportation planning a little bit differently. Give us a sense of what we're seeing across North Carolina with transportation planners. Are they heeding the data?
There's generally a push for more busing and more rail. Rail seems to be more romantic in the ideas of planners and especially media. But busing, at least, if you're going to look at public transit, then busing at least offers a choice and a range of routes. Once you build a rail line, you're stuck with it. Busing can adjust to people's choices in ways that rail just simply cannot.
Let's talk a little bit more about rail, because here in North Carolina, we have a rail contingent in the Charlotte area, and we have a line there. And then there has been a multi-year effort in the Triangle for several of the major counties to try to bring federally funded, at least in part, a rail system to the Triangle. But it kind of met its demise several months ago. Give us kind of the landscape of what happened there.
Yeah, it's really complicated and fast-paced thing to try to get through. But yeah, basically Durham and Chapel Hill were the ones that went ahead with it, and Wake County wisely said no. And then as planners looked into it with Durham in more detail, they started realizing it was going to disrupt. It was going to disrupt the university, Duke University. It's going to disrupt sensitive laboratory things that were experiments going on, and it really was just going to be very disruptive for the community for very little gain.
And I think at one point in that proposal, there was also an idea that maybe they would have to start tunneling under at least one road in the Durham area. And suddenly a lot of people realized that, hey, this is maybe getting a little bit close to us here, the potential reality of the funding coming through. And then you saw people rising up and saying, look, this really isn't going to work. Now, is that project dead? I think it's dead at this point.
I think it's practically dead.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that even though the project would be dead, there are taxes in place to help fund that. So what happens there? What would you recommend?
Well, I generally want to return taxes to right. people unless they are absolutely necessary.
It kind of makes you wonder what they're spending the money on then.
Right.
Yeah, very interesting. So are there places where actually rail transit does work well, John? What kind of a landscape or a geography do you have to have?
For any of these transit options, you need an extremely dense urban location. And we simply don't have that in North Carolina.
We have a very suburban and rural lifestyle. It's not uncommon, particularly in the Triangle area, for people to live in one county and maybe work one or two counties away. And so the roads is really the number one way. And, of course, this data showing that people want to be in their own personal vehicle and more people working from home. It's a really fascinating look at some of these transportation statistics about North Carolina. You can find it in John Sanders' latest piece posted at johnlock.org. John, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
And that's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.